This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
And today my guest on Off the Shelf is David Dowd. David is a partner at Mayer Brown LLP. He specializes in government contracts and in particular does a lot of bid protest work. And, you know, David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure as always to be here.
Well, David, today we are going to talk about some recent bid protests of note involving the GSA Schedules Program and blanket purchase agreements in particular. But first, I think we ought to just set the stage and, you know, can you talk a little bit about what a BPA off the GSA schedules is in terms of the regulatory framework and what the intent is, and then maybe talk a little bit about the bid protest process and how they intersect, and then we can move on to the cases.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. First, a BPA is a blanket purchase agreement. This is an agreement that is established, and it doesn't have to be only under the multiple award schedule or Federal Supply Schedule, FSS, but typically would be used for that. A blanket purchase agreement sets a framework between the agency that's purchasing something, a product or a service, and the contractor under which the products or the services are sold under particular terms, and those products or services are actually purchased under subsequent orders, and those orders are governed by the framework of that BPA. Under FAR 8.405, a BPA is intended to be used for repetitive needs of an agency. So the theory would be if an agency knows it's going to buy products or services more or less in a common or standard configuration, the establishment of a BPA enables the agency to put some parameters on those subsequent orders and to obtain the benefit of pricing that would apply or that would govern those subsequent orders under the BPA. And under the FAR, as it currently stands for 8.4, there is a preference for the award of multiple BPAs as opposed to the award of a single BPA to cover those repetitive needs.
So, you know, with regard to BPAs then, I just have a question. Is it, and you get to one of the points I wanted to ask about, multiple award versus single award, is, you know, what are agencies doing? Are you using these multiple award service BPAs for program requirements, and then they're competing the orders? Is that the way it works?
That's the way it works. In one of the two cases we'll talk about today, the Verizon Wireless case, the agency was looking to establish a strategic source for a particular product and service. So the agency used the BPA in that context. And you see, over time, you've seen BPAs used by a variety of agencies for similar objectives. I mean, the VA, the Veterans Administration has long used BPAs in the context of purchasing drugs, establish a BPA with a particular manufacturer to obtain those drugs and thereby encourage the use of drugs for a particular application.
That would be a
single BPA, and now there's a preference, of course, for multiple BPA holders such that when it comes time to place an order, the actual order for the particular product or service, the agency would compete that order among the BPA holders, which is the name of the entities that have the BPAs.
Okay, so just sort of big picture, the BPAs are generally for recurring requirements of an agency. They can be single award BPAs, but there's a preference for multiple award BPAs. And if you do multiple award BPAs, then you have to compete the orders, especially like over 150,000 amongst the BPA holders, right?
That's correct.
So, okay, so now talk a little bit about the bid protest process and how it relates to BPAs. I know at one point I got asked the question, this is when I was still at GSA, well, do you protest the award of, or the, quote, establishment of a BPA, or are you really protesting, or should you wait and protest the order under the BPA?
Right.
Because most BPAs, you know, were basically, like you said, a framework for future orders.
Right. Yeah, there's no real work that goes to you directly by receiving a BPA. You would protest the establishment of the BPA. That would be the typical course. And that's what happened in the cases that we're going to talk about today. You could also protest the order placed under a BPA in the multiple award context. I mean, if there are multiple BPA holders and you're one of those BPA holders,
and you lose,
and you lose out on that order, you could contest that order, assuming it's competed without regard to its size. And there's a difference there between a BPA order award and an IDIQ contract award, in that there is going to be a jurisdictional limitation on the latter, but not on the BPA order issued under the schedule.
Yeah.
In terms of the protest process, there's something I did want to mention that will be relevant, I think, to some of the cases we talk about, and that is at GAO, the Government Accountability Office, there are timeliness requirements that apply to protests. There are two basic rules that are of note here. One rule says that if the issue that a party has with the bidding documents, the party makes an allegation that the bidding documents are somehow unduly restrictive or don't fairly reflect the agency's needs, that kind of a challenge, that is a dispute with the terms of a request for quotation or a request for proposals, that kind of dispute has to be brought before the due date for the submission of proposals. And if a change is introduced by amendment, the party has to bring it before the next due date. Separately from that, if an agency wants to take issue with an evaluation issue or the award
you
of
mean
a contract.
A company.
A company does, yeah. Right. Wants to take issue with the award of a contract or the evaluation of a proposal, those kinds of issues, what are classically referred to as evaluation issues, need to be brought within 10 days of when the party knew or should have known the basis for that protest. And there are a couple of wrinkles around that don't really matter for our discussion here. But generally speaking, for purposes of our discussion here, solicitation defects have to be brought before the due date. Evaluation issues have to be brought within 10 days of when you knew or should have known of what the evaluation problem was.
Okay, I think I follow that, David. That was pretty clear from my perspective. So, well, why don't we just start in on some of the decisions that you want to talk about? It's kind of setting the framework, and I think let's talk about one that I think is very significant. I think it's not just for the schedules program, but it's for commercial item contracting generally, and that's the Verizon Wireless decision. It's a decision that came out September 17th, 2012, and it did deal with strategic sourcing and some sort of government unique terms that were included in a BPA under the GSA schedules, which, you know, frankly, how they added these additional terms that were also seems to me inconsistent with the underlying contracts is a whole nother discussion. But go ahead, tell us about this case.
Sure. This was a decision by the Government Accountability Office, GAO, regarding a BPA that the General Services Administration was looking to establish for wireless devices and services. So here we had the agency, GSA, looking to use a BPA to implement a strategic sourcing approach. And as we mentioned earlier, a BPA is a really good way to do that, because what you have is you have the ability to set some parameters around these recurring needs that you'll have for products or services, and not have to do all of that framework down at the level of individual orders. Instead, you can say, let's award some umbrella-type agreements where we lay out the kinds of terms and conditions we have and that we will have for many orders. And we can do that at one time through the establishment of BPA, in this case multiple BPAs, and then have subsequent competitions for those orders later, but they're governed by that framework of the BPA. So that's what was at issue.
Right, and so you know, what, in those cases, what they include some estimated quantities and that sort of thing.
Right. And you'll also have additional, you know, price related terms, which is really what was at issue there, or technical requirements, which was to some extent also at issue in the Verizon Wireless case. So what was the issue then in Verizon Wireless? The RFQ, the request for quotations that was issued by GSA, had a number of terms that were set out and invited the parties that were responding to raise objections to those terms, so they could call out exceptions to the terms that were set forth in the RFQ, and Verizon Wireless did that with respect to at least four terms that are at issue in the protest decision. Verizon Wireless took exception to the terms essentially on the basis that they were not consistent with customary commercial practice.
Right, and they did that when they submitted
their initial offer
included exceptions to the RFP.
Right. With some rationale for why it is that Verizon Wireless thought
those terms. Pursuant to the GSA's instructions.
Right. So GSA invited offerors, bidders to do that. Verizon Wireless did that. GSA then responded to Verizon Wireless disagreeing with Verizon Wireless's position that those terms, those four terms that are issued in the case, were inconsistent with customary commercial practice. It was obviously GSA's position that they were consistent with customary commercial practice. And I'll say there's a provision in the Federal Acquisition Regulation that says when an agency is buying commercial items, it is only supposed to include government unique clauses or, if they're required by statute or regulation, beyond that, the agency, there may be a host of other clauses that are not required by statute or regulation, and an agency generally may include those clauses, but it can only do so if the inclusion of those clauses is consistent with, quote, customary commercial practice.
Well, you know what, David, right now it's customary commercial practice to take a break. Okay. So we'll have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more with David Dowd, partner at Mayer Brown LLP, and we'll continue our discussion of the Verizon Wireless decision and what it means for commercial item contracting. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance. Join the Coalition for Government Procurement on October 24th and 25th for a two-day training conference, Continuing the Dialogue, at the Crystal Gateway Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. The training will focus on understanding acquisition policy and the federal market, hear how sequestration, declining budgets, and strategic sourcing may affect what the government buys and how they buy it. Any government and industry professional from across the procurement community should attend this event. Register now at the Coalition for Government Procurement's website, www.thecgp.org.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to David Dowd, partner, Mayer Brown LLP, and we're talking bid protests and GSA schedules and BPAs and, you know, timeliness and all these good things, these legal concepts. Right, David? David, you were about to get down in the details of the Verizon Wireless decision and what it means and basically what happened, why it was decided the way it was, and like all the key issues. So I'm just going to be quiet now and let you continue.
All right. Thanks a lot, Roger. There were two basic claims that Verizon Wireless brought when they filed the protest at GAO. First, Verizon Wireless claimed that the four clauses that were at issue there in the case were not consistent with customary commercial practice, which, as I mentioned, is a requirement that clauses be in a commercial item contract. Second, Verizon Wireless argued that the clauses, even if they were otherwise appropriate, were unduly restrictive of competition and therefore couldn't be included. And GAO, for reasons that I'll get into, never reached that second issue. The entire case turned on whether the four clauses at issue were consistent with customary commercial practice. And the short of it is, and somewhat surprisingly, because this doesn't happen all that often at GAO, GAO found that the four clauses were not consistent with customary commercial practice. The essence of the holding was that GSA failed to provide reasonable evidence that it had done market research to substantiate the inclusion of those four clauses.
That they in fact were used out there in the marketplace.
Two of the clauses at issue I thought I'd talk about a bit because they're quite interesting. The first clause, what was called a price maintenance clause, and this was a clause that essentially said if the contractor were to offer to any user of the BPA a discount for a service that was more than 10% below what the BPA pricing was, that pricing then had to be extended to all users of the BPA. So it's a variation on a price reduction clause, which is a clause you typically see in
right. It's a price reduction clause on top of the price reduction clause that's already in the schedule contract. This was a BPA under the schedules.
Right. So it's a modification to that, but an interesting one, I think, in a lot of ways. The second clause was called the sales leakage clause, and this clause essentially said that the contractor had to go out and track the sales it made to the users of the BPA, and if it turned out that the users were buying from the same contractor in some other means, the contractor had deemed those sales to be BPA sales under the same terms and pricing, and also had to encourage that user in the future to make sure it used the BPA. So basically, the contractor would have to follow the agency's purchases around and make sure that they were consistent with the BPA.
Well, that's interesting, David, because that's always been an issue of what is a schedule sale. Mm-hmm. That's always been an issue that GSA takes an expansive view of, and particularly those who review or audit the contracts versus, you know, like you get instructions, make sure you put, you know, if you're a contractor, you want to, if it is a schedule sale, you got to document, make sure that's clear, you know, in the transactional paperwork, whether it's identifying the contract itself on the invoice or that sort of thing. That's a variation on an ongoing sort of contract administration issue and term as well.
It is. And it's a significant burden to the contractor because the contractor would then have to essentially point out to the using agency when the agency opted to use some other contract vehicle that the agency should have used the BPA instead. Obviously, the agency could have, well, being an authorized user of the BPA, the agency itself could use the BPA. But in this instance, under this clause, the contractor would have to go off and direct the agency back to the BPA and extend the same pricing and terms as would apply under the BPA if the agency, in fact, had used it. And Verizon argued that the two of these clauses—
I just want to one more observation. You tell me this. This is like I'm thinking this through in my head, and I'm thinking that the way this is structured— GSA has them coming and going. I mean, it's either a sale under the contract, or if you're given a lower price on another contract vehicle, you know, that's got to be offered as well. I mean, it's almost like that by the way it's termed, everything almost becomes tantamount to being.
Right. Every sale by that contractor to an authorized user of the BPA would essentially be a BPA sale.
Yeah.
And the BPA sale.
One way or the other.
And because BPAs are, I mean, essentially the way a BPA is priced, it's a discount off your schedule pricing. So now every user is going to get a discount off the BPA pricing, either by using the BPA or being directed to the BPA or under the price maintenance clause that I just mentioned, to the extent a sale is made by that contractor to a using agency of a service that's more than 10% below the BPA price. Now all the users get that, even if the sales that we're talking about weren't in fact made at the time under the BPA. So yes, the two clauses together had a pretty pernicious impact, or would have, on the contractor. So Verizon Wireless, unsurprisingly, objected to these clauses as being inconsistent with customary commercial practice and also unduly restrictive. And GAO didn't reach the unduly restrictive point because GAO found that it was not consistent with customary commercial practice, at least GSA couldn't show that it was, to impose these types of burdens on the contractor. And the case is interesting, I think, in two respects. First, there aren't that many cases where GAO has looked into what is a commercial item and assessed the market research that an agency has done to substantiate a particular burden that's imposed. And therefore, GAO has not had that many opportunities to opine on whether something is or is not consistent with customary commercial practice. So it's good for contractors in the sense that GSA said, look, here is an FSS sale, you know, a BPA, and we, GAO, are going to look at whether or not the terms of that FSS order, in this case a BPA, are consistent with customary commercial practice. Because at the end of the day, a sale under the schedule is the sale of a commercial item, or the acquisition of a product or service under the schedule is the acquisition of a commercial item. That's very good, I think, for contractors. The thing that troubles me about the decision, a good result, I think the appropriate result.
Well, first
is
I have a question before you get to what troubles you. What evidence did GSA present to support?
And that's what troubles me, which is
you're
anticipating
what
I was going.
Wow.
Essentially, what GSA offered up in terms of research were declarations by the individuals who had done market research alluding to sales in the commercial market that were consistent with these terms. There weren't a lot of details on that. In terms of the details that GSA did provide, they relied both for the sales leakage clause and primarily for the price maintenance clause, which is the major clause that was talked about in the case. GSA relied on instances where other agencies purportedly had purchased under similar terms. In particular, an Air Force BPA was cited in the context of the price maintenance clause. And then sales to state and local governments were cited in the context of both the price maintenance clause and the sales leakage clause. And GAO discussed this market research. What troubles me about the case is the fact that GAO discussed that evidence as being potentially sufficient to support the restrictions that were being imposed by GSA. Now, GAO found that the particular instances that were cited by GSA weren't the same terms and conditions, weren't fully the same. So GSA couldn't show that those terms and conditions were quite the same as the price maintenance clause and the sales leakage clause that were at issue. Problematic, though, was it seems, at least when you read the decision, that GAO might have accepted it as sufficient to establish that a practice is consistent with customary commercial practice if the agency could show that some other agency had bought it that way,
well, that
without
makes,
regard to what actually happened with commercial
that
buyers.
That makes absolutely no sense to me,
no,
Dave.
And,
because a government, relying on a government unique government term to say that so what you're telling me is an agency's use of a unique government term could potentially be considered a commercial practice because that another agency had used it,
right?
Not whether it was actually used in the commercial marketplace or not.
Right, not whether it was used independent of the government. If you're the second agency through, you might have a chance to establish that unique practice is customary commercial practice. The first agency through can't, I think, is the lesson of this case. And that's troubling. That's troubling.
So is this like, I mean, you're really scaring me here in the sense that, it sounds like GA will go down a path of basically bowing before the idea of agency discretion, somehow allowing one agency to rely on another agency's unique term to say that unique term is a commercial practice. That's absolutely illogical.
That's at least the prospect suggested by the case. I mean, otherwise, you would think how the case would read would be that GAO would say, the agency didn't have any detailed examples from the commercial market, and to the extent that the agency offered up examples of what the Air Force or some other agency bought, those are completely irrelevant. Because they are, by definition, not commercial. They are instead governmental purchases.
Well, right now, David, we have to continue that commercial practice of breaking for commercial, actually. So we'll have to take a break right now. But when we come back, we'll be talking more with David Dowd, partner, Mayer Brown, LLP. And we'll continue our discussion of bid protest case law and the GSA schedules program, in particular BPAs. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to David Dowd, partner, Mayer Brown, LLP, and we're doing one of our bid protest updates. We've had some interesting cases hit the presses recently with regard to GSA schedules and BPAs, and David's been kind enough to join us today to talk about those. And David, you wanted to make a couple other points about the Verizon Wireless decision?
Yes, just a few more. The interesting point, I think, as I mentioned, Verizon Wireless, the government was Government Accountability Office was looking at the question of whether or not the particular clauses at issue were consistent with customary commercial practice. And as evidence of whether the clauses were consistent with that practice, GAO looked to, at the urging of the agency, looked to unique terms of other purchases, acquisitions by the government, by the federal government. And the question that raises to me is, how could a practice be a commercial practice if the only evidence of it, or even the primary evidence of it, was a government purchase as opposed to a sale to a non-government buyer? When you look at the Federal Acquisition Regulation, there is a long discussion in the definition section toward the front of the FAR, as we call it, where the FAR defines what it means for something to be a commercial item, and in that definition repeatedly refers to non-governmental entities or non-governmental purposes, and distinguishes that from the federal government. So it would seem that looking at that definition, the federal government is not a commercial buyer, and its practices are not, by definition, commercial practices. So it strikes me as odd that in the Verizon Wireless case, there would be a discussion of unique government practices in the context of another BPA, for example, by the Air Force. Why that would be any evidence of a customary commercial practice is a bit of a mystery to me. And more broadly, I think the case is interesting because it talks about what are typically or long have been viewed as fairly onerous terms by industry, in particular the price reductions clause, which the Verizon Wireless case assumes to be there because it is a BPA under the federal supply schedule. So, of course, that price reduction clause applies. And then it talks about how the price maintenance clause that was at issue differs, if at all, from the price reduction clause. But what was lost, it seems to me, was the opportunity to look into whether or not the price reduction clause is itself consistent with customary commercial practice. It would seem from a reading of the case that all of the provisions of the multiple award schedule contracts would have to be, because they are acquisitions of commercial items would have to be consistent with customary commercial practice, unless a waiver has been executed by the agency, which wasn't the case in the Verizon Wireless case. And when I look at those clauses, the particular two that we've talked about here, the price maintenance and the sales leakage, they don't, to me at all, look like clauses that are consistent with customary commercial practice, in that they impose significant burdens in terms of tracking other sales and reporting other sales and extending new pricing to a customer on potentially a much smaller order that you've given to another more favored customer.
On a much larger
order, because it's committed to exclusivity with you or made other concessions that would be important to any company that's selling a product or a service.
Yeah. Well, that goes to something that I've been talking about, and that's putting commercial back in commercial item contracting. I think over the years we've seen this growth of government unique requirements being layered on the GSA schedules, on BPAs or orders under the GSA schedules, but on commercial item contracting more generally in the standard clauses. And, you know, from my perspective, I'd like to get your thoughts on it, but it seems to me what that does is it ultimately increases transactional costs for the government. In an effort to get this better deal, between the cost associated with trying to put it in place, negotiating it, but also how the risk that it imparts on contractors, somehow, some way, that gets translated into increased costs to the government overall through additional overhead, through factoring that risk. And it also, it seems to me that, you know, by imposing these commercial terms, there's another big thing, is it actually, you know, reduces competition because it creates barriers to entry into the federal marketplace by, you know, traditional commercial firms who may want to participate, but they see these government unique terms like a price reduction clause, whatever, and they see it as a barrier to compete. You know, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. I mean, you know, the reason why commercial items were first encouraged, you know, back in 1994, Congress encouraged the acquisition of commercial items. And in doing so, there was a recognition that in order to get those companies to compete and in order to get the benefit of the lower prices and better solutions, perhaps, that some of those companies would be able to offer, there was a recognition that fewer burdens would have to be imposed on those companies, right? The burdens imposed had to resemble what those companies experienced to the extent possible out in the commercial marketplace, in which case those companies would be more willing to come forward and offer those better solutions and lower prices that Congress believed were available out there in the market. And as we add more burdens to those companies, as we impose additional clauses that weren't there before, which certainly is a trend, I think you're right, over the last few years that more and more clauses are being added, or as we fail to really diligently scrutinize a particular practice to see whether it is consistent with customary commercial practice, and we start to accept a government-unique practice as being somehow a customary commercial practice, I think we've lost that focus. And if you follow the logic through, we should at some point, maybe we already are, losing the benefit of those very solutions and prices that we had hoped to that we would get when we started down this road back, you know, almost 20 years ago.
Right, and I would submit from my perspective, I think commercial item contracting at FASA was one of the most profound changes in the procurement system in providing, you know, lower costs, lower transactional costs for government and for the contractors as well. And what do I mean by that? I mean, before that time, and I'm old enough to say I was in government before 1994, I mean, well before 1994, but, you know, there was a spec for everything of some sort of description. Whether you're talking about files or ashtrays or whatever that the government was buying, you know, nobody buys ashtrays anymore, but, you know, that's how old it can go back. But the beauty of, you know, the commercial marketplace is like, I need, you know, a screwdriver. I need a file, you know, and there's many companies who are very successful in the commercial marketplace making those. And the pricing is better than having some unique description that there's only one or two companies that are building to it because it's a very small market and they've sort of captured it. So I think it had a profound effect in reducing overall cost to the government. So, and it's so important we start thinking about that, especially as the budgetary pressures we're facing. So, you know, with that, are there areas that you think are lessons learned that government needs to think about with regard to commercial item? I'm thinking like strategic sourcing and data collection.
Yeah, in particular, I mean, you know, as the agency is going forward with their strategic sourcing initiative, one thought I would leave for them would be take a look at what you're asking for. I mean, do you need the data that you're soliciting? You know, I tend to see over time agencies looking for a lot more data perhaps compiled in many different ways than a contractor typically would keep. And I think, again, if we're doing a commercial acquisition, if we're buying commercial products and services, the federal agency should try, to the extent possible, to emulate those customary commercial practices, both in terms of the clauses that are imposed, but also in terms of the data that's being solicited. If commercial buyers are willing to accept a lot less data, it seems to me the government shouldn't need all that much more data to buy the same underlying product or service. If the theory is that the commercial market protects the buyer, it also protects the buyer in the sense of the amount of data the buyer should have to seek.
Right. Well, if you ask for data that's inconsistent with commercial practice, you're asking a company to build systems or change processes to collect that data. That costs money.
Right.
So the government, I mean, data is not a free good, I mean,
right.
Fundamentally. And I guess the other thing that, you know, you made me think of when you mentioned that is, you know, I think it's important, will be important moving forward is that, you know, not only relying on commercial practices, but engaging industry, having that, you know, I'm going to use cliche, the Mythbusters term, you know, having a dialogue about what the data needs are and what the government intends to use it for, can better inform the contractors as to what systems they already have. You know, maybe they already have the data collected, you know, that they can provide, or maybe it is going to cost them money, but having an informed discussion and dialogue about that will lead to better outcomes.
I think that's true. I mean, again, remember, Verizon Wireless was a case about market research. You know, what market research did the agency do? And that's the part I think you're talking about. Dialogue between the government and industry is market research. Better market research, yeah, leads to better results in terms of acquisition. And I think that's one of the lessons of the Verizon Wireless case.
Right, and market research is required by the FAR. So it's not a new idea, right?
Not at all.
Right. Well, David, right now we have to take our last break. You know, customarily this is the last break. You know, so when we come back, we'll be talking more with David Dowd, partner, Mayer Brown, LLP. And we'll move on to a couple of these interesting decisions that have come down regarding BPAs off the GSA schedules. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to David Dowd, partner, Mayer Brown, LLP, and we're talking bid protest and the GSA schedules. And, David, there's a couple other decisions of great interest, I think, with regard to the schedules program and the operation of BPAs and the evaluation of BPAs in particular. Care to enlighten us?
Sure. There are two cases that came down out of the Government Accountability Office, GAO, in August that involved the award of BPAs under the schedule, so the same general topic we talked about with Verizon Wireless. And each of these two cases, one was called Cyber Data Technologies, and the other was called GlowTech. And both of these decisions involved a decision by an agency to establish a BPA, in this case, you know, in both cases, multiple BPAs, with entities without considering the prices that were offered for the BPAs. So what you had is, you know, companies put in a BPA proposal or an offer.
Or maybe not sufficiently consider the pricing.
Right. Yeah, a little bit difference between the two cases, CyberData versus GlowTech. In CyberData, the agency didn't consider it at all. In GlowTech, they gave it some consideration, but not sufficient consideration. So essentially, in each case, the offerors for the BPA provided price-related data, but in the one case, CyberData, the agency, which was GSA, decided not to consider it at all. And in GlowTech, the agency was USAID and gave some consideration, but GAO found inadequate consideration to the pricing terms. And in each case, what GAO essentially said was, in the establishment of a BPA, an agency must consider price. Price must be an evaluation factor and must be given adequate consideration when the agency establishes a BPA. Now, one of the differences between the two cases and why I think discussing the two of them is worthwhile is in the CyberData case, which came out a few weeks earlier than GlowTech, GAO invoked an exception to its normal timeliness rules, which is what we started talking about at the outset of the program. And the relevant rule there was if a company wants to complain about the term of an RFQ, request for quotation, or a request for proposals, the rule at GAO is you have to speak up before your proposal goes in or you've waived that claim. In CyberData, the RFQ at issue was very clear. GSA was explicitly clear that it was not going to consider the pricing that was submitted in deciding which companies would receive a BPA. And true to form, GSA did not consider it.
So it was supposed to be just pure technical qualifications?
Purely on the technical considerations alone. Even though, somewhat oddly, the companies were asked for BPA pricing, at the same time, GSA said, when we pick whoever we're going to pick for these BPAs, and they ended up picking about a dozen companies, we are not going to consider price at all.
So I have a question for you, Dave, and maybe this is a surprise one, but or a trick one, or maybe just a logical one. That is, you know, with regard to the BPAs, you know, is this requirement to meaningfully consider price or adequately consider price, is it purely regulatorily based, i.e. is it in the FAR that in BPAs you have to do this because the rule's been rewritten, or is it go back to this underlying Competition and Contracting Act? And I ask that because it is a agreement, a framework for future orders under contracts that have had price negotiated and established, and subsequent orders would be competed presumably on a price basis with technical, or you could say that that's a requirement. So that middle thing of the BPAs, is it purely a regulatory requirement, or do you think it's a statutory as well?
Yeah, this goes to the great ambiguity of BPAs, something we kind of alluded to at the start of the program. I think in this context, it's probably a regulatory requirement. You know, there is a requirement in statute to consider price as a factor in the award of contracts. But again, as you note, the BPA is not a contract. And the odd thing about a BPA under the multiple award schedule contracts is it really is this intermediate device. I mean, you've got the price established at the award of the contract or the extension of a relevant contract option, and then you're going to have competition for the orders. So you've got a price, which is the schedule contract price. I mean, that applies, and an agency could very well place an order for that, and that would be fine. I mean, placing an order at the schedule price would be consistent with the competition requirements. You know, generally speaking, assuming that they do, but at least there would be a price, and a price would be established, and that would be a fair and reasonable price. You know, buying at the scheduled contract would be buying at a fair and reasonable price. And yet, at the same time, because a BPA is established, there is by definition, because there's a preference for multiple BPAs, there is going to be a competition for those orders. So the agency is actually going to pay a lower price than what's set forth in the BPA. So the agency could buy at the schedule price, and that would be okay, and the agency, in fact, will buy at a lower price than the BPA. And what GAO is talking about in these cases is the agency has to fairly consider the intervening BPA price that the agency, in fact, will never pay, in all likelihood will never pay. And that is really driven by, according to the GAO sites, provisions of the FAR, you know, regulatory right. requirement to consider price. But bear in mind, the agency will consider price. I mean, in one respect, it already has when it set up the BPA in the first place, and it certainly will going forward when the orders are placed.
Right. And, you know, I think that's, you know, when you think about the FAR rewrite of FAR 8.4, I think this is an area where it could have been, you know, greater flexibility could have been provided to agencies in terms of, you know, if you've got those contracts negotiated, you have pricing, you know, why not have the ability to do a framework where you award multiple BPAs based on technical capabilities. Then when you have specific program requirements, you compete those BPAs and you do have to evaluate price at the order level. I mean, to me, that's a more streamlined process, you know, than trying to, you know, evaluate price in some manner at a BPA level. It seems to me there was an opportunity lost there, as well as this preference for multiple award BPAs. You know, for example, the VA does a lot of BPAs for individual drugs. You know, and they're, you know, and I know one of the concerns there is, can they still do that?
Right.
I mean, that's a question, you know, people who practice in the area have great, you know, and those have been very effective in meeting mission requirements for the VA and for their vets. So it's kind of interesting that the rewrite eliminated some of these flexibilities that are inherent in the program.
Right. And instead, what we have is additional burdens. I mean, CyberData is a great example in the sense that there were about three dozen companies that put in proposals originally. And GSA, again, had said quite clearly it was not going to consider price when it established the BPAs. But that's a lot of burden. I mean, it's a lot of burden to go through all of those different proposals to look at the adequacy, the reasonableness of pricing that, in fact, the agency will never pay and right. should not pay because, you know, again, the FAR encourages the award of multiple BPAs and requires competitions under those BPAs. And so the BPA pricing is not the pricing that the agency will pay.
Right.
So when we say the agency should consider price, I mean, it has once considered price in establishing right. the schedule contract, and it must again consider price, a different price,
For a specific requirement.
For a particular requirement. And so that intervening price is really odd, in that all it does really is it sets a ceiling for the future orders in some sense, but it's not the price that the agency will pay. You know, one of the odd things about the schedule is that the schedule was supposed to be an administrative convenience, you know, an easier way for agencies to buy commercial products and services. Another way that agencies sometimes buy commercial products and services is through what we call GWACs, government-wide acquisition contracts, where, you know, there will be the establishment of something like a schedule in a lot of ways. You'll have 2 or 5 or 10 contracts awarded to companies, and those companies will then compete for individual orders. And GSA has recognized that in the award of those initial contracts, again, price has to be a consideration in the award of the contract. And one might say, well, that's kind of similar to here, in that you're looking at the reasonableness of a price that, in fact, the agency is never going to pay because they're going to have a competition for the orders. And that's true. It's similar in that respect. But the difference is when you establish a BPA under the schedule, you do it 3 times. You have pricing looked at 3 times, and in those GWACs, you have pricing looked at twice.
Right.
It seems that if the schedule is supposed to be easier to administer and impose fewer burdens on the government and agency, it would be at least ironic to have 3 rounds for the schedule and 2 rounds for other contracts.
Right. That's a great point, David. Yeah, and Glotech, any thoughts on that case?
Yeah, Glotech, it seemed like one of the challenges the agency had was, you know, how do you meaningfully figure out, because you don't really know what your particular requirements are going to be, and that's what the orders are for, you know, how do you know them well enough to evaluate price at the BPA level, again, realizing you're going to evaluate price when it comes time for a particular order. And I guess there the model would be to look at other what agencies have done in other contexts, and that is you come out with a sample, even if it's not necessarily representative of every order you're gonna put forth put through the BPA, if you can come up with some sort of sample task to look at price in some sense, that's what GAO I think is looking for in the Glotech case. I think the challenge for agencies is trying to figure out, well, now that we're gonna try to pick winners, if you will, on the basis of price, we have to feel pretty confident that that's the representative order.
Right, and that gets back to your point of it's, you know, you're doing it 3 times on the schedules versus twice on other contracts. Whether it's a GWAC or not, it could be another IDIQ.
Right.
And that's really not the way the schedules
are. Right, the schedules I think were set up to say, look, let's establish a contract price, a price that's fair and reasonable for an agency to pay, such that the agency could place an order at that price, and it's already been determined that's fair and reasonable. So you've done it once. Why do it 2 more times?
Right. Well, David, you know, we've reached the end of our show today. I thought we could talk another hour, hour and a half, whatever, about GSA schedules and bid protests, but we have to go. So I want to thank David Dowd, partner Mayor Brown, LLP, for joining me on the show today. And I'll see David on Thursday this week at our fall conference. The Coalition's hosting a fall conference. And Jack Horan from McKenna Long to talk about all these issues and more. But David, thanks for being on the show. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Join the Coalition for Government Procurement on October 24th and 25th for a 2-day training conference, Continuing the Dialogue, at the Crystal Gateway Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. The training will focus on understanding acquisition policy and the federal market, hear how sequestration, declining budgets, and strategic sourcing may affect what the government buys and how they buy it. Any government and industry professional from across the procurement community should attend this event. Register now at the Coalition for Government Procurement's website, www.thecgp.org.